Hey, everybody. Welcome to Mercy Hill. My name is Andrew Hopper, and I'm the lead pastor here at Mercy Hill. We're excited that you're here tonight with us as we are now on our second week of a new series that we're in the book of John called The Word. What we are doing over the next 7 or 8 weeks is we're going to look at the concepts that John raises in the first 18 verses of his gospel that he then fleshes out through the rest of the gospel, all right? So in the first 18 verses, he kind of will bring some stuff up, big thematic, really just big concepts that will take the rest of the book to flesh out. But many of them, much like any good book is, an introduction, they make an appearance, all right? And so that's kind of what we've been doing. We'll be doing that tonight. So if you have a copy of Scripture, you can go ahead and take it out or turn it on. If you have a phone, that's what most people are doing now. Scroll down to the bottom, go down to the book of John, and we're going to be in the first 5 verses again tonight, okay? So the word, John, go ahead and get there. Now, I realize that over the last couple of weeks, we have been, taking on some pretty heavy topics here at Mercy Hill. This happens for us because we're committed to just kind of preaching through the Bible. And as topics come up that are hard to deal with, we just have to deal with them. And so I know that, and I know that it's an easy job for me because I just stand up here for about 40 minutes and just blast away, and then I tell you guys to go ask your community group leaders all the questions you have. So that's a very good little model that I have going on. But the reality is I just want to acknowledge that I know over the last couple weeks we've been dealing with heavy stuff. I mean, 2 weeks ago, talking about the problem of evil. How is there a God if evil is in the world? And then last week, dealing with the doctrine of the Trinity. This stuff is not easy. It's hard, and people disagree with it. A lot of people have gone away encouraged and challenged, and people have gone to their community groups or just left the building and been like challenged by this. Other people have gotten mad, and I hear about that. They're just like, hey, I don't agree with this. I think you're way off on this. And you know what? I invite that. I commend everyone who has come for being here, even if you don't agree. And I'm always fine with hearing your critiques. You can blast me however you want. My email is bobby.harrington@gmail.com, okay? Just send me an email whenever you feel the need to, and he will get it, okay? So the reason I tell you all that is that tonight is no different than the last 2 weeks. Except for that, it's probably more controversial. The last couple of weeks we've been dealing with hard things. Tonight is just that way, and I haven't necessarily planned it like this. But as we have begun to walk through the book of John, just in the first 3 verses, there are huge, crazy things about Christianity and Christians that we believe that I think have to be talked about and have to be dealt with in a manner that isn't just, hey, believe it, that settles it, move on, but actually kind of dig in and deal with it. And tonight, we're going to deal with that, all right? In the first couple verses last week, we talked about the Trinity. This week, as we get into John chapter 1, verse 3, we're going to deal with the creation. Did God really create the world? The Bible says that God created through Jesus, and that Jesus, God, they were all a part of the creation process. And that's something that may be hard for us to deal with. And tonight, really all I want to do is kind of settle on this verse. It's very easy. It's a very simple verse. And then I just want to ask the question, all right, the Bible says that God created. Did he create? And if he did create, then what does that mean for our life, okay? Now, I know right off the bat, there's a couple probably of different types of people in the room tonight. The first one, you might just be like, hey, look, man, I'm a Christian. I've been a Christian since I was a kid. I know that there's a lot of people that say a lot of different things about science and does it, contradict the Bible and all this stuff about creation, but that's something I put to rest a long time ago. The Bible says it, I believe it, that settles it, okay? Now, if that's where you are, actually, that's great that you have faith, and that's good. But the reality is that I want you to be, and I want us at Mercy Hill to be a people who are missionary people, that we are out in the community, in the arena of ideas, where there are people that don't agree with us and don't believe like we do, and we're able to put forth a new paradigm as they are putting a new paradigm on us. If that's going to be the case with you, then you need to be able to at least engage this stuff. So if you're already in your mind going like, hey, man, I've heard this. I believe in creation. I believe that Jesus created. So you're kind of turning off. My question to you would be, if you got in a conversation like I got in a couple of months ago, where I sat down with a guy, and about halfway through the conversation, he looked across the table, and he said, well, hey, man, science has already disproved God and the Bible anyway, so what's the point? Would you be able to say, excuse me? You want to, like, unravel that a little bit? I might want to throw my own hat in that ring. Or would you kind of be sitting there going like, man, I hope he doesn't push on me too much. because I don't know this stuff. If you're a Christian here tonight and you're immediately like, well, I don't know if I really want to engage, I would push you to engage tonight. All right, just jump in, get involved, and but listen, the second type of person that might be in the room tonight is the exact opposite. It's like, hey, I'm not a Christian, and maybe this is even why. I made my mind up about this kind of stuff a long time ago. I had the biology class, I had stuff in college or whatever. To me, it seemed pretty definitive that we don't need God anymore, we don't need the supernatural, so what's the point? My push on you would be, you're here anyway. I mean, unless you're gonna leave, you're here anyway. I mean, you respect us enough to come in, and man, we're excited that you're here. Why not open up, say, hey, man, I'm gonna have an open mind, I'm gonna give it a shot, see what the word says, and that would be my push to you, okay? All right, so here's what we want to do. We want to dive into John chapter 1. I want to kind of just make sure we have the context and all that kind of stuff, even from last week. And then we're going to get into this big issue that we've been in, that we're going to get into tonight, all right? John chapter 1, verse 1. Here's what the Bible says. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God, and He was in the beginning with God. Last week, this is where we spent our time, if you remember. This is the unique thing about Christianity. This is unique to Christianity. We're not Muslims. We are not Jews. We're people who believe in one God that can be God and with God at the same time. That's kind of the essence of the Trinity. Wrapped up in this one little verse we talked about last week is a doctrine that is very hard for us to get our minds around. It's hard, and I would push on you, don't use analogies because you will probably become heretical in doing so, all right? There's nothing really like it in the world. Whenever we say, hey, the Trinity is kind of like this, nope, it probably isn't because it's pretty unique in all of the world. What we believe about God is that He is one God, He is also three, and each is distinct, each is divine. That's kind of what I said last week, right? God is one, that's what God says in the Word. He says, I am the Lord, there is no other. Now, you might say He's wrong about that. You might say, well, I don't believe that. But if He is saying, I am the Lord and there is no other, don't put that cross on the same bumper sticker with everything else on the coexist bumper sticker, right? Because what you've realized is, hey, no, if this one is saying that it's exclusive. Now, it could be wrong. Obviously, I don't believe that it's wrong. But you could say it could be wrong, but it can't be right and all the other ones be right because He is saying, I am the Lord and there is no other besides me. God is one, but God is also three. Okay, good example. This is why we baptize in the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost. Okay, we're going to be baptizing tonight. All right, our baptism as a church plant is a horse trough. Okay, so people will, we put the curtain around it so you don't see that, but people get in it. Well, we're going to ask them. We're going to say, hey, do you believe that Jesus has saved you? If they say yes, then we're going to say, would you follow Him as Lord the rest of your life? If they say yes, we're going to baptize them. What are we going to baptize them in the name of? The Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. God is one, God is also three. And just to recap again from last week, each is God. Jesus, for example, in Colossians 1 and Colossians 2 is called the image of the invisible God. And the Bible says that in Him, the fullness of deity dwells. Now, this is what we talked about last week. In the beginning was the Word was with God, the Word was God. And here's our money verse for tonight, okay? And all things were made through Him. And without Him was not anything made that was made. If it was made, it was made by the Son of God. If it exists, Jesus is either it or He made it. What I mean is there's only two types of things that exist in the world. There's creator and creation. And if it's in creation, that means that Jesus made it. That's what the Bible is asserting here. Now, this is classic John, okay? If you read the book of John, you'll see this. Here's what he does. He puts forth a positive, and then he reinforces that positive with a negative, all right? All things were made through Him. To be emphatic, he says now to the negative, and without Him was not anything made that was made. Now, here's the great thing about tonight, especially if you're coming in, maybe it's your first time or whatever. I'm not doing any like little magic tricks up here tonight. There's no like, hey, let me show you this in the Greek where it doesn't look, where, you know, it kind of looks like it means this, but it really doesn't mean, nope. This is as plain as it can be. If you can read, you understand at least what the Bible is trying to get you to see. And that point is very clear. If it's made, Jesus made it. If it's made, God made it. The world was made by God. You and I, made by God. Hebrews chapter 1, verse 2 says, in the last days he has spoken to his son, whom he appointed over heir of all things, through whom he also created the world. This is a biblical doctrine. Jesus is active in creation. He is there. God is creating. He is doing it through Jesus. This is what the Bible is pushing us to. All right? Now, let me kind of keep explaining that just to make sure we have it, and then we're going to move on. Let me go ahead and read the rest of the passage just so we have it. And in him was life, and life was the light of man, and the light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. Now, the reason I read that tonight is because I want you to see something that John is doing. John is anchoring the first three verses of his gospel in Genesis chapter 1. He's doing that in order to show you that he's not talking about some otherly creation or whatever. He is talking about the creation from Genesis 1. You say, where do you get that? The phrase, in the beginning, the concepts of light and dark, the concepts of a giver of life. What is he playing on? He's playing on Genesis chapter 1. This is very common in the Bible, okay? Very common. It's very common in our culture. I can give you one statement, and that statement anchors you somewhere else in the Bible. That's what John's doing. It's what we do. If you were in a history class or whatever, and I said this, if I said, the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. A lot of us know that quote. That quote, I remember in history, American history, I can anchor that. That one phrase, and I know where you're going, okay? People that are 30 years old, I'm 30 years old, of my generation, if I said, we got no food, we got no jobs, our pets' heads are falling off, okay? Everybody says, dumb and dumber, all right? I got it. I know where you're going. If I say shake and bake, you're like, got it. Talladega Nights, I see that. I remember where I was. I remember the whole movie. I remember the plot line. One phrase to anchor you somewhere else in the world. The Bible does that all the time. Jesus is on the cross, and he says, my God, why have you forsaken me? Why does he do that? He's anchoring you in Psalm 22. He's saying, hey, go back and read Psalm 22. Psalm 22 is a messianic song that talks about everything that Jesus is going to go through. My God, why have you forsaken me? Everybody thinks, wait, Psalm 22, oh, now I get it. You see what I mean? I anchor you somewhere else. Paul does the same thing. If you think about Paul in Ephesians chapter 6, Paul begins to opine about how we can, you know, interact in warfare with Satan. And we can use the armor of God in order to do it. He talks about the breastplate of righteousness. He talks about the helmet of salvation. Why does he do that? I've heard all these different explanations before about like, well, you know, he was sitting between two Roman guards and he was looking at their armor and obviously he's playing off of their armor in order to draw this parallel. That may be true. I have no idea. Nobody knows. But I can tell you exactly what he's doing. He's anchoring you into Isaiah 59. Where the Bible talks about Jesus and he says he put on a righteousness as his breastplate and the helmet of salvation on his head. He's trying to show you that Jesus will be coming in order to win the battle. One phrase to anchor you. Why am I saying all that? John is anchoring us in a real life creation of the world. That's what he's doing. Is it spiritual? Yes. Is there a lot of stuff he's going to talk about with Jesus being creator? Yes. Is he anchoring us in the real life God spoke into nothing and the world was made? Yes, he is. And I think it's important for us to get that because then we begin to realize, okay, what the Bible is saying is that Jesus has created all things. Now, we can agree with that or we cannot agree with that, but that is certainly what the Bible is teaching, okay? Now, here, my cards are on the table. You ready? Jesus created the world. I'm a Christian. A lot of you in here probably are not Christians. I am a Christian. Jesus created the world. I go, got it. I believe that. It fits everything in my worldview. I believe that in Jesus' resurrection, I can trust him as God. And if he points me back to Genesis and points me back to a lot of the things that I see from the early times in the Old Testament, I can trust my Bible. If Jesus, in a historically reliable document, which was the New Testament, talks about how he's God, resurrected, pushes us back to the Old Testament, then I begin to believe that the entirety of the Bible, historically reliable, pushed back, now I'm starting to believe that the whole thing is divine. That's where I'm at. That's what I believe. When they say, hey, Jesus created the world, I go, yeah, I get that. But the reality is that some of you in here, you immediately reject that. And what I want to do tonight is, and I know tonight's a little bit weird, okay? Tonight is extremely heady. And it's centering on this verse. I've already done the explanation. What does it mean? It means Jesus created, okay? But what I want to do now is say, yeah, as a Christian, I believe that. But if you don't believe that, the big, giant elephant in the room is probably because somewhere in your, you know, history or your classes or whatever, someone has convinced you that science has already undercut that. And that Darwinianism, naturalism, macroevolution has already demonstrated that there is no place for God, that we don't need God, that God was not the first cause. It has already proven that, just like the conversation I had with the guy earlier a couple months ago that said, well, hasn't science already proven that the Bible and all of that is just nothing? See, what I want to do tonight is say, Christians, there's a lot of reasons we could put forth to say, I believe. But what I want to do for just a few minutes tonight, probably 20, 25 minutes tonight, is deal with this question, all right? Did God actually create? And what I want to do, I'm just going to deal with that question, and then I'm going to deal with the question of what it means for my life. But in my time tonight with did God actually create, I'm not going to put forth a bunch of positive stuff. What I want to do is realize with our college population, with how many young people we have in our church, realizing that, man, our if you look at the numbers of high school students that grow up for 18 years, they move off to college, and within 2 hours of their first biology class, they might not be a Christian anymore because somebody has undercut what they believe. Knowing that that's the case, and this is personal to me. This is should be personal to a lot of y'all. Because the reality is that, you know, I know our church is full of a lot of young kids. We just commissioned 12 parents the other day to raise their kids in the faith. We've got 40 kids down there between our two services. Some of those are my kids. Them kids are going to grow up. And we're going to have them for 18 years, and I'm going to talk to them for 18 years, and then somebody else is going to start talking to them. The reality, and some of you college students, maybe you're here tonight and you're like, well, that's my story, man. I grew up in a church and I got my first class and I realized, like, man, if the Bible says that God created, but science says that God could not have created and the Bible is wrong and I've just kind of thrown my lot in over here. Maybe that's even where you're at tonight. So what I want to do is this. Did God create? There's a lot of positive things I could say, but I want to spend my time with the elephant in the room. And I want to say, if you are a person who has said, man, I won't believe that Jesus created the world because of science and analytical and logical and all that. What I want to do is just try to shake that foundation. Cards are on the table. There's nothing hidden, okay? I want to try to shake that foundation enough for you to potentially accept something that I know pushes against the worldview that you have right now, all right? So here's what we're going to do. I've got five things under Did God Create that are all just guiding thoughts. They're big. Let me just, if I was talking to you personally one-on-one, what would I say? This is what I would say. These five thoughts, obviously this can't be comprehensive. We're talking about a 25-minute portion of a sermon. There's a lot of you can read on this. I hope that you will take this into your community groups and bat this stuff around. Get with somebody, talk about it. But I've got five thoughts here that I want to talk to you about here for just a few minutes, all right? Bent on shaking that foundation a little bit, if your answer is no to why God created, and the reason is because science has shown you otherwise, all right? That's as best as I can set it up. Here we go. The first thought I would have that I would want to share with you in order to ruffle that foundation is this. I know you don't believe it, but everyone has faith in something. Whether you realize it or not, you have faith in something. Now, I know that, listen, this one is very heady, okay? The whole thing is a little heady tonight. I know this one's very heady. So for some of you, that intrigues you. You want to, you know, you're kind of turned on by that. Like, hey, okay, some of you, you might be turning off. Catch us back up in about 7 minutes here, okay? Because we're just going to dive in. I want to deal with this. The first one is this. Everyone has faith in something, whether they realize it or not. Isn't this the critique that's leveled against Christianity? Hey, you guys, or not even Christianity, that's not fair. Any type of theism, Islam, Judaism, anything. You believe in the supernatural, therefore you are not logical, you're not analytical, you're not scientific. Because a scientific, logical, analytical person does not believe things that cannot be demonstrated to them. This is the critique that gets leveled against Christianity. And what I want to show you, I mean, without trying to be too simplistic, but what I want to show you is that everybody has faith in something. Here's what I mean. Let's take logic and let's take the scientific method. Maybe you would say to me, hey, I'm one of those persons. You say I've got faith, and I say, no, I don't. I'm very logical. Okay, I'm very analytical. I don't believe anything that cannot be demonstrated to me through logic. The problem is that statement in and of itself is self-refuting. When you say, I don't believe anything can be true unless it can be demonstrated through logic, what you have said is actually failing. It's self-defeating. The reason is because you cannot use logic in order to explain how logic is true. You can't reason through logic in order to get that logic is a source of truth and the way that we get to truth. In philosophical circles, and if you get in arguments very much, you might know this, but that's a logical fallacy. It's called begging the question. When you beg the question, what you have done is you have assumed your own conclusion in your argument. So what you have said is like, hey, I don't believe anything unless it's logical, but you believe that logic produces truth, but you use logic to get there. That's begging the question, and it's out of bounds. I mean, any logic class you go into, you would realize. That's why when it comes to logic, there are things that we call foundational beliefs. There are things that the community just has to accept in order for any type of language even to be meaningful and in order for our conversations to not be nonsensical. You have to just come around and accept certain things. Logic is one of those things. You assume it in order to use it. See, everything then is not physical, but it is built on a metaphysical, extra physical, not physical. Something is real that is metaphysical. And that's where logic lies. Hey, I can use logic to reason things out, but ultimately that sits on a non-physical, metaphysical belief that says that logic can produce truth, which is a statement that can't be produced true using logic. Let me give you a better example. I know this is a little bit heady. I know that, okay? The scientific method, for example, this will be one maybe we might be able to get our hands around a little better. So you think about the scientific method and you realize that, yeah, the scientific method, observation, you know, hypothesis, testing things, this is good. Can we learn things from this? Absolutely. Is science the enemy of Christianity? No. Okay? You think about for the first 500 years of science, they were all theists. Louis Pasteur, Boyle, Isaac Newton, all these guys are Christians. Why? Because they realize that I can have a scientific method about the physical as it rests on a metaphysical belief about God. I can do science in the world because the world is reasonable. Why? Because a reasonable God created it. That's why you see all these guys were theists in the beginning. See, here's what you do. You take the scientific method and you say, okay, observation, hypothesis, I don't believe anything that can't be empirically verified or tested through science. And I would say that's silly because you believe in the scientific method, which in and of itself can't be tested scientifically. See what I mean? It's self-refuting. And here's what I'm trying to get you to see. It's very easy, all right? The Christians who began the scientific movement, what they were doing was saying, I have this metaphysical belief that God is reasonable. And because of that, I can build a scientific method on top of it. That's what I can do. I can build it on top of that. I know that if I keep regressing my beliefs all the way back down, they get to something that's non-physical that I have to accept as being true. But that's okay for me because I'm a Christian. See, what you do when you come in and you say, well, I don't believe anything that can't be scientific. I don't believe in any of this other stuff. I don't believe in, you know, anything is real and if it's not in the natural world. This is kind of what you're doing. What you're doing is, it's like when we were all like 10 years old and you're playing Jenga, okay? And let's just say it's like an epic Jenga game. We've all been in a few of those, okay? And you're getting like way up. And we all want to be that guy who takes the bottom one and takes it out, and everything falls and doesn't move. Did it ever work for you? It never worked for me, okay? That's kind of what you're doing. You're saying, hey, I get that they've built the Jenga tower on a metaphysical belief that there is something true about the world that you can't demonstrate through science, and I've built it. But what I'm going to try to do is take out that foundation. What happens? It all crumbles, okay? Now, all I'm trying to get you to see is that there are real things in the world that are not physical. There are real things in the world that you don't get through your analysis and logic. There are things that are real. You would say, well, you know, okay, fine, I get what you're saying. Maybe I do believe in a couple of things that I can't demonstrate. Well, now we're talking. Because now the critique that you level against me as a Christian, potentially, to say, well, you believe in things that can't be demonstrated. I say, well, hey, we all do. It's just, where do I put my faith? Am I putting my faith in science, or where is it? You know, we all believe in things that are not necessarily something that is physical. This is actually the second point I would say, and it kind of ties really closely. Science cannot speak to the metaphysical, all right? This is what happens. for science to end up saying something like, hey, you know, you guys believe, and like we're talking about tonight, that God created the world, but that can't be proven scientifically. Actually, science has disproven that God has created. At about that time, I would stop you and I would say, wrong. There should be buzzers going off because you've made a category mistake. What you said is science, which deals with necessarily with the physical, has now jumped categories and made a claim about what we call the metaphysical, something that is not natural and not hard that I can touch, but is a real thing. If someone says, hey, well, the science has already proven that God could not have buzzer, category mistake, you can't do that. There are real things in the world that we would believe, real categories within the metaphysical. Think about love. Think about friendship. A naturalist has nowhere to go other than to say those are nothing but synapses firing in your brain. But deep in our core, just as this song we sang earlier, there's something in me that I know there is more to this. I know there is more to love and to desire and to friendship than synapses firing in my brain. This week, I went to a wedding that I was in. Okay, I'm 30 years old. I kind of thought I was past that part of my life. One of my best friends in the world, man, that I grew up with, wouldn't have missed his wedding for anything. What does a wedding entail? Driving down to Orlando, man, hanging out with a bunch of guys that I don't really know anymore. You know, I mean, just all this kind of, buying a suit, you know, all this kind of stuff. Man, I love this dude. I wouldn't miss this for the world, even though it's kind of a hard thing to do, right? You don't be in a wedding unless friendship is real. Okay, let's just be honest. I saw a story, you know, you might be like, well, all synapses firing in your brain. Let's think about this. I saw an article this week about a dude in Florida, married like 10 years, kids, everything. Wife walks in one day, he's gone. He's just not there. They're like, where's he at? This dude was a Cuban spy. He's back in Cuba. He has left. They have kids together. He has a wife. He was undercover the whole time, had a job, everything. He's back in Cuba. Even a naturalist would look and they would say, oh man, you know, and she's devastated, heartbroken. What's the difference? Well, her love was real. His love was fake. Gotcha. See what I mean? Love is a real thing. We understand that. We understand that there are these categories. Science as a natural science has no place in speaking to those things that are metaphysical. Let me give you a good example of this, then we're going to move on, all right? At the 100-year mark of The Origin of Species, which was Darwin's work that kind of, you know, unlocked a lot of stuff for everybody in the 1800s or whatever, the guy that was named Darwin's Bulldog, the guy that would do a lot of his kind of front stuff, he's a guy named T.H. Huxley. His grandson, Julian Huxley, was asked to give a speech commemorating the 100-year mark of Darwinism. Here's what he says in the speech. He says, all aspects of reality are subject to evolution, from atoms and stars to fish and flowers to human societies and values. Buzzer going off. You have confused categories. What you are saying is that everything has to be natural. That you're saying in my natural science, I have now concluded that this stuff in the metaphysical is not real. You've confused categories. You've made a mistake. He says again, in evolutionary pattern of thought, there is no longer either need or room for the supernatural. Buzzer. You have confused categories again. Now listen, I don't mean to sound like cavalier when I say this, but it's the honest truth. My kids are 4 and 2. If they were 12 years old in like fourth grade or whatever that is, fifth grade, and they came to me with a paper they had written to put in their class, and I read it, and it had such an egregious logical fallacy in it, I would tell them that they are smarter than that and that they ought to go rewrite it. I would say that to them. I would not let them put that forth with a category mistake of that magnitude, even in a speech in a fifth grade class, okay? But this is kind of what we assume. Science speaks to the metaphysical all the time. Has no place. Thirdly, the scientific method method obviously cannot be employed to say anything about how the earth actually began. Now, I want to be clear again. I'm not setting up science as the enemy of Christianity. What I'm saying is that science, in its inception of realizing the world is reasonable and we can dig in and even see things about that book of Revelation, the world, as Bacon called it, then I would say, hey, that's great. But when you were taking the Jenga piece out and using it to cut back against Christianity, which gave birth to you, then I would say something like this. Well, hey, you want to talk about the scientific method being used and disprove the origin of the universe using that? I mean, come on, who was there? it should shock us when we see people say like, well, science has like shown me and demonstrated to me the proof that God could not have created the universe. If someone said that to me in Darwinian dogma, which is what it is, unquestioning, you can't question this, that, I would just look at them and I would say, okay, science, observation, hypothesis, testing, reproducing, all that kind of stuff. Here's what I would say. I would say, well, did you observe it? And they would say no. And I would say, oh, okay. Well, can you test it? And they would say no. And I would say, okay, can you reproduce it? And they would say no. And I would say, then what are we talking about? Okay? If science has proven something about the origin, it's a unique event. No one was there. Can't say that. Fourthly, I would say this. Let's all stop getting hung up on the small stuff and see the big picture, all right? Let's stop getting hung up on the small and let's see the big picture of what God is doing. Man, the Bible tells us that God has created the world, that he has created it for his glory, that he's created it with a purpose in mind, that you and I are all created with that in his mind, with a purpose for his glory. These are the big rocks, that God has a story, that he is love, that he is powerful, that he is created. These are the big rocks. This is what we need to be contending with. Instead, we talk about how old the earth is. I don't know how old the earth is, okay? I have no idea. I bet you don't know how old the earth is either, all right? I don't want to get bogged down in a discussion about like dinosaurs and was man with them or were they on the ark or whatever. I'm not saying there's not a place that we can discuss that stuff, but if you're here tonight and you're like, or you know somebody that's like, man, I can't get past, you know, I think to become a Christian, I got to believe that creation happened exactly this way. I can't become a Christian if I don't believe the earth is exactly this age or whatever. I would say you got to dig deeper into the Christian community. In the Christian community, there are men that I respect immensely on all sides of this discussion. People that believe all types of different things about the way that God created the world. The question is Hebrews chapter 11, verse 3, right? That by faith we understand that the universe was formed at God's command. Is this what we, let's go there. Let's go to the big rock. Let's don't squabble about the small rocks. Let's go to the big rock. Did God create this universe for his purposes? Is Jesus recreating this universe and our heart for his purposes? This is the big rock. Let's spend our time there, all right? And fifthly and finally, talking about creation, our passage tonight, Jesus has created the world. If someone came to me and they said, hey, John chapter 1, verse 3, I don't believe it. And the reason I don't believe it is because science has proven that it's wrong through its evolutionary theory, all right? What would I be trying to do? What am I trying to do this whole time with my four thoughts of tonight? I would want to shake that foundation. And one of the ways, the last way that I would want to shake that foundation is I would to say, if believing John chapter 1, verse 3 is out of bounds for you, because of science and because of evolution, then let's talk about that and let's realize, fifthly, that Darwinism, naturalistic Darwinism, and macroevolution have serious holes in them, and it's just a fact. Now, dogmatically, it has become the new religion in science, and it has been for the last 150 years, and there have been dissenters along the way that are immediately, not even Christians, people that aren't even theists, but people that question it, that immediately kind of get crucified, if you will. They get thrown out. But the reality is that there are holes, and I want to give you just a couple of them. Just for the, remember, all I'm I wouldn't be trying to do a bunch of science and, hey, let's go to the science and prove the Bible. Nope. I just want to shake that foundation that much. What I would do, the first thing I would do is I would ask someone if they really understand the difference between microevolution and macroevolution. Microevolution and macroevolution end up getting bled together in this weird kind of evolutionary theory, and they ought not be, they ought to be separate. And the reason is because microevolution is certainly a fact, can be demonstrated, and I'll demonstrate it to you right now, all right? Microevolution is this idea that as things kind of adapt to their surroundings, that even the survival of the fittest, the stronger ones can survive. And within one species, you can see wild adaptations. Why do we see totally different breeds of dogs or horses or cows or whatever? You see these adaptations within the same species. Let me give you an example. I read an article the other day about a protection dog, all right? You guys don't know what I'm talking about, like a German shepherd, like they're trained to, somebody comes in the house and they've got all the German commands and all this stuff, and it's like the cops with the, you know, the canine cop, whatever, that type of dog. This dog sold for $225,000, protection dog. Why could a dog sell for that much? Because he's been micro-evolved, honestly. Because what people have done is they have selectively taken traits over the last 100 years, and they have produced in this dog a quickness, an awareness, a bone-crushing bite, I'm sure, okay? You know, a way to, you know, a way to stay calm in the heat of battle, and all of that in this dog. They have been breeding them along generation after generation, taking the best, breeding them with the best, generation after generation, until they've come out with a $225,000 dog. Now, that's an idea of microevolution. It happens. It can be documented within the same species. Here's the problem. The problem is, when we were all in our biology class or whatever, this idea of microevolution, which Darwin kind of put forth into macroevolution to say, hey, this idea that we see can also end up adapting species, that things no longer stay within their species, but they can become a different species altogether. This is that's the theory part. That part gets blended in where everybody says, oh, well, it's just evolution. No, there's a distinction. Macroevolution is not microevolution, and macroevolution has serious problems. And I'll give you just a couple of them real quick, right? The first problem is this. Maybe no one ever told you this, but macroevolution, where you have, like what I mentioned, was like a dog that becomes a different type of dog, but is still a dog, all right? Macroevolution would be like that dog becomes a hippopotamus one day. That's the difference, micro, macro. Macroevolution has never been observed. Thousands of years of history, hundreds of years of scientific history, and somewhere you would think that someone witnessed a cow give birth to a horse, okay? Hasn't happened as of yet. The second problem with macroevolution is just the reality that it is not in the fossil record. And this is highly problematic for people who are naturalistic macroevolution Darwinists. See, it became apparent in the 1970s that for 120 years, 110 years after Darwin's Origin of the Species, that people at a popular level, like us, I'm not a scientist, many of you aren't scientists, people like us had been led to believe that the fossil record in Darwinian dogma, that the fossil record showed all of these transitional forms where the proverbial cow was becoming, you know, a sea lion or whatever, where you could see the transitions in the fossil record. Because anybody with a thinking brain would say, hey, if these things evolved over time, you would be able to see all the transitionary periods at which they had. And then in 1970, a guy named Stephen Jay Gould, who was actually trying to prop up Darwinian evolution, not a believer, he comes in and he looks at the fossil record and he puts forth a new idea called punctuated equilibrium. This is what he said. He said, the fossil record shows no transitional periods like that. That's not what it shows. What it shows is in a certain area or whatever, you see things in their full form like we have them today or like are extinct that pop up. And they'll pop up as a full form like we have them today or in their extinct nature. And he said, well, hey, maybe evolution then happened in bursts. That it wasn't like this transitional period, but it was like this big burst that happened and everything began to change. Well, when he did this, people looked at it and they said, well, I get you're trying to prop up Darwinism, but you know, that looks like another theory that I've heard. Like, if there are that many gaps in the fossil record, kind of what you're telling me is like the horse has always been a horse. Always. And it's the horse that we have now. Is that kind of what you're saying? And it's kind of like, well, yeah. And it's like, I think I've heard another theory like that before in my life. You see what I mean? The macroevolution certainly has other problems. Another thing I would say is this. We have to deal with the fine-tunedness of this universe that we live in right now. If someone said, I can't believe Genesis 1:3, like you said, did God exist? No. Why? Because science has proven that God does not exist. To shake that foundation just that much, I would say, well, have you thought about how finely-tuned this universe is? I mean, 66,600 miles per hour is how fast this Earth orbits the sun. If it was any less or any more, we would be in a whole lot of trouble. If it was less, we wouldn't offset the gravitational pull of the sun, and we would be sucked in. our Earth sits at a 23.5-degree axis, degree on its axis. If it was any more or any less, we would either burn to death or freeze. There's 21% oxygen in the air. That 21% oxygen in the air, if it was any more than that, we would burn to death in wildfires all over the world. Listen, I'm not naive enough to think that the naturalists might say, well, see, we're finally to, this was the exact right formula to give us the life that we have. I know that that could be leveled, but I'm just saying in common sense, as we're sitting here tonight, what makes more sense? That this earth just happened to produce us, or something produced such a finely tuned system. There was a guy named William Paley who put forth a watchmaker analogy. He was crucified in scientific circles forever, and now people are kind of coming back to what he had to say. And they're kind of coming back and looking at it. Here's what he said. He just said, if I was walking through the woods and I tripped over a rock, I would look down and I would say it's a rock. If I was walking through the woods and I tripped over a clock, I would say, well, there must be a clockmaker. When something gives off that impression of design in that way, then it might be safe to assume that it was designed, all right? I want to just give you a few things like that in order to shake that foundation. Did God create, if your answer to that is no because science has disproved it, I think that would be a wrong assumption. At least one that we ought to continue to investigate further, all right? But the money question for tonight, and really why we're all here, is to say, hey, you know, God created, but what does it matter for my life? And that's the second and final question that I have for you guys, all right? Did God create? Obviously, I believe he did. But maybe you're sitting here tonight and you're going like, okay, yeah, I mean, some of the stuff you're saying about like, yeah, I guess I never thought about it. There are a few things I take on faith. Or, yeah, that's fine. I mean, maybe I need to go back and look at the fossil record. I guess I just always assumed or whatever. But maybe tonight you're sitting here and you're thinking to yourself, all right, but what does it matter to me? Let's say God did create. Just give me that for a few minutes. Let's say God did create. Then what does it matter for my life tonight as I go home? Well, I think there are three. There's probably a lot. Honestly, this list started at about 10, okay? So if you're having trouble paying attention, I've cut it down to 3, all right? So you can thank me for that later. I want to show you 3 things. If God did create, there are 3 things about you that you ought to know, okay? And I want to finish with those tonight. The first one is this. If God did create, as John 1 says, if Jesus created us, if God was active in the creative process, then the first thing you need to see is that Jesus created you for his own glory. See, if you begin to accept that God created us, the natural question that arises is why? The simple answer is he created you for his own glory. God is glorious. He is the supreme being. And as he has created in order that glory would return to him. This is why the Bible says that the heavens declare your glory, that we ought to declare his glory among the nations, that as Jesus was landed here on earth in the incarnate body, we look at Christ and we behold the glory of God. God is glorious. Why did he create? Jesus created because of what Colossians 2 says. He created the world through Jesus and to Jesus. It is a reflector. He is created for his own glory. Now, here's the reality, okay? If you aren't a believer in here tonight, if you know someone who's not a Christian, this is the heart of the issue, what I just said. For the non-believer, this is the heart of it. The heart of it is not necessarily the science has led me to this belief or whatever. The heart of it is, do you like the ends that pushes you to? Why is there so much backlash in the scientific community about anybody who puts forth an argument that says, hey, the world looks like it might have been designed by someone? In 2002, there was a debate held at the American Natural Science Museum up in Washington. And here's what happened. They were going to bring in a creationist, an intelligent designist, intelligent design guy to say, hey, I'm a biologist, I'm a molecular biologist. The world looks like it's been designed, and a guy who is a Darwinian naturalist evolution guy to say, no, it doesn't. They were going to bring them both in and have a debate. Sounds very scientific to me. Let's talk about it. Let's put forth the ideas. Nope. The backlash from the scientific community, the backlash from everybody that kind of reads that magazine was this debate should not happen. Why such a backlash? Is it because of the science, or is it because of what the science ends up pushing us to? I don't mean about God created the world. I mean his purposes in it for his own glory. Are we rebelling against the science, or is the rebellion against, I don't want to be made in his image. I don't want to be one who is made for somebody else's glory because I live for my own glory. Richard Dawkins wrote a book called The Blind Watchmaker. In it, he says, this is fascinating to me. In it, he says, biology is very interesting or very tricky or very complex because it gives off the illusion of being designed. Why does it have to be an illusion? It has to be an illusion. Because if it's not an illusion, maybe me living only for myself is not right. Maybe this body being all there is and this world and this joy and these synapses, maybe there's more to it than that, and I don't want to live for somebody else's glory. That's where you're at tonight. Maybe you've never even been able to verbalize it. Maybe tonight you say like, no, I'm logical, I'm analytical, I stick to the science, God this and God that, and it's all about the evolution. If that's where you are, I would ask you this. If you are convinced of that, if you are convinced there can't be a God because of evolution, because of Darwinism, have you read at least 10 books that tell you that? If you haven't, I would say you're pushing less against the science and you're pushing more against the God that created you. You're pushing more against, I don't want the end game, so I'll just settle for this little bit of anything I can grab to say he's out there and he doesn't exist. God created us for his own glory. Y'all, the second thing you can know about yourself, and just give it to me for a minute, all right? Say, okay, he's created, that's fine, or whatever. God created. If he created, then it means that you and I are very, very special. If he has created, it means that man is very special. You go back to Genesis, and what you see is that God made man in his image. He breathed life personally into our lungs. We are the pinnacle of his creation. He has created us a part of creation, and he has set us apart from creation. We are a part of creation, but we are set apart from creation as we bear the image of God. You are special. You are special. You are special to him. Okay, I know that the world pushes on us, and it tells us that we're just part of the natural world. I mean, it's unbelievable to me how much of this stuff gets pushed upon us, all right? I read a book, or I saw a movie the other day called A River Runs Through It. I don't know if you've seen this movie or not, okay? Trout fishing, Montana in the 1900s, the boyish good looks of Brad Pitt 20 years ago. Excellent movie, okay? Maybe you've seen it. The end of the movie is, this guy's reflecting on his whole life. The whole end of the movie is, the final reflection of his whole life is, in the end, everything melds into one, and a river runs through it. And there's this river and this giant life force, and everything just folds into this one stream of life. Great poem, okay? Very bad theology. That's not what the Bible teaches. What the Bible teaches is that you are not a part of nature in that way. You are something else entirely. You are special. You're on a pedestal, if you will. God has crowned his creation with you and I, all right? Another example of this, okay? Sadly, my show, Snake Salvation, is over, okay? We all pray to God that it gets renewed. new show, Life Below Zero, I think is what it's called. It talks about these four or five different families that live about 700 miles north of the Arctic Circle, like way up in Alaska, and how they fight for their food and all this kind of stuff. This one dude, okay, he lives in a shack about as big as this rug that I'm standing on, and he lives about, out in the middle of absolutely nowhere. This guy lives out there by himself year-round, and he happens to be a philosopher also, okay, and a social commentary. He talks a lot about the civilized people, all right, that live like down in the city, you know. And he talks a lot about them, and he talks about how he is so much more healthy both mentally and physically as he has become part of creation, or part of the world, I guess. He probably wouldn't say creation. Part of the world. He is living how his life has been intended to live, and he's trying to convince you of that by saying things like, hey, we're just one of the animals. You know, I'm taking my place kind of in the circle here. Again, very interesting TV show. Very bad theology. That's not what the Bible teaches you. I was horrified last night. I'm driving back from Florida, and my little girl is sitting in the back seat. My little girl's 4 years old, and she is singing this song from Disney movie, Pocahontas, okay? Let me just show you, all right? This is what she sings. She asked me to turn the radio up as she's singing it. She sings, "The rainstorm and the river are my brothers. The heron and the otter are my friends." Okay? This is the part that's horrifying. You ready? "And we are all connected to each other in a circle, in a hoop that never ends." Okay? Circle of life. I'm like, no. Bad theology. Great movie. Great poem. Okay? Bad history and bad theology. We are a part of creation, but we are a part of creation. The rainstorm is not my brother, okay? I don't have all that much in common with the animals. I know we act like that. Not true, okay? It baffles me. I look, watch like the Discovery Channel. People are like, hey, look at this monkey. It's so smart. Someone taught it how to sign language the word food when it's hungry. I'm like, we have an international space station. I mean, as impressive as that is, okay? They're like, look, he's got a rock. He's figured out how to use a tool. He's like opening a coconut with it, okay? I don't even know if they eat coconuts or whatever, but you know what I'm saying? They're like, he's hitting it. I'm like, oh, they've learned how to use tools. I'm like, we have bulldozers and cranes. I don't have all that much in common with, you know, the animals around me. I was at the summit. Okay, I worked at the summit for 5 years, and one of our student pastors came in, a dude named Brandon. He came up to the church one time. It was like lunchtime. He was all frazzled, everything. I'm like, dude, what's going on? He said, well, I had to go home because our dog, we just got a dog like a week ago, and it's going nuts, man. He's like, it's eating like the whole house. I got to go home like every 3 hours and let this dog out because he is just going crazy. I said, dude, the dog's young. Like, why don't you teach it? Why don't you crate train it? And teach it to be in a crate and just calm, like teach them to just relax. I mean, they sleep a lot during the day anyway. Like, why not do that? And he said, you know what, dude? I want to do that. But he said, you know what? My wife looked at me and said, hey, Brandon, I mean, how would you like to sit in a crate all day? Then he looked at me and said, what would you say to your wife if she said that? I said, bro, I would tell her I have opposable thumbs, okay? I would open the crate and go make myself a sandwich. That's what I would do. I'm not a dog. Don't explain this idea of the dog sitting in a crate and me sitting in a crate. I am special. And so are you. God breathed his life into me, mankind. God has put his image on us, mankind. We are not this one big hoop of life, rainstorm, breathe. You know, this is not. The reality is that we are very, very, very special, but I know that some of you in the room tonight don't believe that anymore. And it's possible that you don't believe that anymore because somebody has fed you a bunch of stuff about naturalism, Darwinism, and you're just one of the animals or whatever. But it's also possible that you don't believe that anymore because of the way that your life has turned out so far. And you are thinking to yourself, if God has all this for me and all these purposes for me, and I'm special like you say, then why X, Y, and Z? I want to tell you something. I don't know exactly what has gone on in your life, but here's what I know. God has created us. He has put mankind on this earth. And when we sinned collectively and have rebelled and run away from him, he could have crushed the whole thing, but he didn't. You are still special to God for one simple reason, because as God has created you, he has sent his son to recreate you. In your sin, you are separated from God. God has sent Christ to come out, be incarnate in the flesh, take on mankind, that he would walk through this life, never sin as you and I have sinned, and in the end of his life, he would lay down on a cross and die that your sin might be erased. God has created us to live in paradise. Don't let this world fool you as if this is what we were created for. This is not what we were created for. We were created for this paradise. It is shattered, it is broken, but God is recreating it and putting us into something that is brand new. And something that is better. Have you ever thought about it like this? Have you ever thought about how, man, your heart is never satisfied? There are things in this world, and you look and you see things, but you realize that at the core of who I am, I'm not satisfied. I desire something that isn't found in this world. A man named C.S. Lewis, a long time ago, said, when you see that your ultimate desire is for something that is not found on this world, maybe it shows you that you were created for another world. God has created us. He is recreating us for that paradise, all right? You are special in his sight. And the last thing that you can know as I close tonight is this. if you give me that God has created, then what you will realize is that God has created you for a purpose. That purpose, I would say, is to glorify him. But here's what I would say. As is anything else in life, if something is not fulfilling its purpose, that life is dull and it's not full. Jesus said, I've come to give you life, and I've come to give it to you more abundantly. That's the words of Christ. Your life will be full when it is fulfilling its purpose. I think about it like this, okay? I think about like a football. You think about a football, all right? A football is still a football when it's sitting up on a shelf somewhere. But a football was made to sail through the air and to have thousands of people cheering and to be caught and to run into the end zone. That's what it was made to do. It's still a football when it's sitting on the shelf. But when it's in a game, that's what it was made to do. That's when joy will be full. That's when many people walk around through life and they're just like, why? As a Christian, I never have to worry or wonder about that. I am created for his glory, and my joy will be most satisfied when he is most glorified in my life. That's my purpose, all right?